Everybody. We've already had one oral argument. We're about to have another one, but let me introduce everybody again. My name is Dana Womack, and to my left is Judge Brian Walker, and to my right is Judge Mike Wallach. And the case we are hearing right now will be called by the clerk.
The court will now call Hawa Mohamed Nata versus the State of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Frank Snyder will argue for the appellant. Ms. Frederica Sargent will argue for the state.
Thank you very much, Mr. Snyder.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Flint Schneider, and I represent the appellant in this case, Hawa Nata. This appeal follows appellant's conviction for driving while intoxicated out of County Criminal Court Number 10 of Tarrant County. The appellant filed a motion to suppress at the trial court level, challenging the legality of the investigative detention, which the trial court subsequently denied. Would your honors like a brief recitation of the facts in this case?
I think we're all familiar. I don't need it. Do you
need
it?
Okay, great. The single issue before the court today is whether the trial court erred in denying the defendant's motion to suppress on the basis that the interaction between the defendant and the officer in this case was a encounter rather than a investigative detention. We believe the answer to that question is yes for three reasons. First is that the interaction between the appellant and Officer Wilson in this case constituted an investigative detention rather than a mere encounter. Two, the investigated detention lacked reasonable suspicion of any criminal activity. And three, that the officer's invocation of the community caretaking function in this case was not reasonable. To my first point, the interaction between Officer Wilson and the appellant became an investigative detention once he pulled behind appellant's vehicle, blocking it in with his emergency lights on. Now, regarding the standard of review in this case, normally this court would give near total deference to the trial court's findings of facts, especially the historical findings of facts in a case like this. However, under the Carmouche case from the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals in 2000, says that the court may give de novo review in instances where the video evidence in the case indisputably contradicts a finding of fact or implied finding that was made by the court in their reasoning.
Is your understanding of that case and what it says, does it go against you and for you, depending on how you look at it? And what I mean by that is, does it kind of open up the door for us to be able to look at it de novo for all intents and purposes, or only based on what the video shows? We're stuck to that.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Justice Walker. So I believe that the Carmouche case would limit, especially how it's written, and in fact, this court's decision in the Blankenship case a couple of months ago, I think it limits it somewhat to the order or series of events that might occur where the video might contradict it.
Is that exactly what happened here?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That's exactly what happened here, isn't it?
Right, is that we're not disputing necessarily anything that turns on credibility, just the order that which it happened. We come here willing to concede that the information contained in finding of fact number 7 in this case, even if Your Honors wanted to believe that all of that happened, the order is what's most important, especially in an analysis as to whether the defendant was detained or in any type of search and seizure case. And those particular facts become important in what order the officer actually perceived those facts and the timeline in which it happened. And so in this case, much like the Carmouche case, we have a situation where all we're arguing is that de novo review should be applied to the singular finding of fact, because the way we look at it is there's basically two scenarios here. The first scenario, we contend that the investigative detention began the moment that the officer pulled behind the appellant's car and turned on their lights, that there was a show of authority, and that at that point the appellant was not free to leave, nor would a reasonable person be free to leave. If your honors agree that the detention began there, finding of fact number 7 actually isn't that relevant to this case, because the stop under the Durant case held by the Court of Criminal Appeals, the stop is either good or bad at the time it happens. So if your honors agree with our contention that the investigative detention began the moment he turns on his lights, he blocks in her car, and calls out that he intends to make an investigative stop, finding of fact number 7 isn't really relevant to this discussion.
Let me ask a question. The findings of fact were made by a different judge than who handled the hearing, right?
That's correct.
How can a judge who didn't hear the evidence and hear the witnesses make a finding of fact about what the evidence showed?
That's absolutely, that is our position, Your Honor, is that in this case, they can't make the type of credibility determinations that would be necessary and are in fact expected in a finding of fact or conclusion of law. In fact, the judge that signed the finding of fact in this case would be in no better position than this court to evaluate the credibility or demeanor of the witnesses or the series of events that the order of in which these events occurred.
Do you have any authority that says that that's impermissible?
That it is impermissible for another judge to sign off on? No, I do not, Your Honor. I don't have any case law that says that they can't do it. I think as a policy argument, it doesn't make much sense for another judge to step in and make those types of determinations when credibility and demeanor are at issue. So I think that in this case, I think that bolsters our argument for the idea that a de novo review should be permissible in this case. So I think our facts relate to Carmouche in this way. There are significant differences between what you see in the finding of fact and in the actual record.
Let me ask a question real quick. So is it your position then, you think that, well, I guess, let me ask it this way. Do you think we have the ability to just reverse and remand for another suppression hearing?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. And I think that would make sense in this unique set of factual circumstances where Your Honors could say, well, we just don't have enough because we have a finding of a fact signed by another judge. We need to go through this process again in order to have someone evaluate the credibility, demeanor, and especially the series of events that occurred here. And I realize that what we're asking in the de novo review, we're talking about mere 7 seconds of video here. And I don't think that either trial counsel for the state or defense extrapolated some of the facts that become important in this enough to where there could be some confusion for this court or difficulty making a decision as to, what order things came in and what the officer particularly perceived. So I think that would be an appropriate remedy here.
Well, not only do you have a video that's a little bit contradictory to what the police officer testified to, then you have another judge who is deciding what the findings of facts were, and we're not necessarily even sure if he was looking at the video or if he was looking at the testimony. I mean, we can assume, but that adds another layer. You agree with that?
Okay. I do agree with that, Your Honor. I believe that going back to my original point that this was the trial court in this case where the findings of fact are, is that this is just an encounter. We don't believe that, we think that there's at least enough from the video and the record to establish that there is more, it is more than just a voluntary encounter here, that the At the point in which there was a show of authority with the overhead lights being blocked in, not free to leave, and commanding her to roll down the window at least at some point was enough to create a investigative detention here. We know that the appellant was not free to leave in this case because the only two things that are cited here in the record is either the officer believed it was an investigative stop or he believed that it was he was exercising his community caretaking function, both of which would require a seizure, both of which would require some sort of detention where the defendant would not, appellant would not be free to leave. Moving on to my second point, there's no reasonable, Officer Wilson lacked reasonable suspicion in this case of any criminal activity. And this is a fact that he conceded in his testimony pretty clearly. I think what Officer Wilson gets to in this case is just a mere hunch. He says, well, in my training and experience, there have been instances where I've seen somebody in a dark parking lot that where I've arrested them for DWI. But there's no specific articulable facts in this case to indicate that the appellant was engaged in the offense of driving while intoxicated. He plainly concedes at two points on the record on page 15 and page 26 that he had no reasonable suspicion of any traffic violation or criminal activity at the time he approached the vehicle, and that the sole reason that he was approaching the vehicle was community caretaking, which again I would say requires a seizure, requires that the defendant not be free to leave until the officer is able to complete that community caretaking function. And three, I believe that the officer's invocation of the community caretaking exception here was not reasonable. As case law states, community caretaking is divorced from the investigation or acquisition of evidence in a case. And the right factors articulated by the Texas Supreme Court lay out when a community caretaking function is reasonable or not. They lay out four different factors, including the nature and level of the distress exhibited, the location of the individual, whether the person was alone, had access to assistance other than the officer, and to what extent, if the individual is not assisted, presents a danger to themselves or others. There's a great case on this that I think is directly analogous to the case at hand that came out of this court in 2012. That's the Hernandez case, Hernandez versus State. In that case, we had a very similar set of facts. And I also think this speaks to the Hernandez case speaks directly to the distinction between a voluntary encounter and an investigative detention as well. So I think it has multiple uses in these proceedings. In that case, you had a defendant that was parked in a parking lot, a vacant parking lot at night, except it was 2 a.m. as opposed to 10 p.m. as in this case. Their door was open, they had their left turn signal flashing, and the officer pulled in directly behind them, much like in this case, shined their spotlight, but not their emergency light, on the defendant's vehicle and attempted to exercise the community caretaking function in that case. And the court held that this was certainly not a voluntary encounter, that it was a investigative detention, because based on the spotlight and the officer's position of his car that prevented egress by the defendant, that would be a investigative detention, but also rejected the community caretaking exception in facts that very closely resemble what we have here and what we have in the testimony in the record. Number one, we have the officer conceding that there was no distress exhibited by the appellant in this case at all. Number two is that the location is pretty well of the appellant's vehicle, and whether they had access to help was pretty well litigated in the motion to suppress. Trial counsel went through. There was a Quick Trip gas station right across the street, open 24 hours. There was a Shell gas station open across the street, 24 hours as well. It was only 10 o'clock at night. There were cars in the parking lot. Defendant had access to help if they needed it in this case. even though the defendant was alone, it's at best a neutral factor in this case, because there was nobody else there in the parking lot that they could cause any danger to or potentially wreck.
Somebody had had a medical event such as a seizure or a heart attack, you could have everything going on in the world across the street and it wouldn't make any difference, would it?
That's correct, Your Honor. I think this goes to policy, right? The community caretaking exception, we can't just say that anytime anyone is parked or in alone, that an officer has a right to start an investigative detention or a seizure. I think if the officer wanted to truly use their community caretaking and first investigate whether there was a need for community caretaking, he could have approached the vehicle and parked next to it and got out of his car, knocked on the window to see what was going on. He could have not used his emergency lights. I think all of those things would allow him to find out a little bit more information rather than jumping to the conclusion that they needed help and blocking them in and using their emergency lights to show force in this case.
Now, you see the state, obviously, their position is not that it was to show force. It was to basically, it's almost a safety mechanism. I'm turning on my lights so that this person knows I'm a police officer. I'm not some, lunatic or anybody that has, a nefarious purpose. What do you say to that? I'm assuming you'll say that would have been okay, but the problem is it doesn't make you community caretaking. It still takes away from that. Am I right in that?
Yes, Your Honor, and I've run out of time. May I have a brief moment to respond?
Yes.
Great. Thank you. Yes, I think that, if we were just looking at the emergency lights alone, I don't think that would be a problem here. If, as I explained a minute ago, if he had parked to the side of the car with his emergency lights on, I think that would have effectively communicated who he was and what his purpose there was, without causing a situation where the defendant was clearly not free to leave. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Sargent.
May it please the court. Should this court find that the trial court's finding the mere encounter was incorrect, there are still two other grounds which make this denial okay. First is the community caretaking exception, and the second is reasonable suspicion. And I think for both of those exceptions, there's a set of facts that's been overlooked.
Before you even go there, if I
yes,
may,
sir.
So you believe that even though the findings of fact stated it was the one type, mm-hmm. that we are not bound to that we could come back and just
no, as long as there is as long as the facts are supported by the record and there's any theory applicable to the case. And in this case, that would be either the community caretaking exception or reasonable suspicion. The denial can be upheld.
But on the reasonable suspicion, how could we hold that when they expressly asked the officer, there was no reasonable suspicion based on the fact that there was no investigation of criminal activity to approach this vehicle, was there? No. So how can we find that if the officer said there wasn't any?
Not at the time. He says not at the time. He says not initially. It did start out as a community caretaking exercise. And what I want to get back to for just a moment, if I may, is how this all started. When Officer Wilson came on his during his shift, pulled into the QT parking lot, looked across the street and saw the car parked in the lot, in this abandoned parking lot, engine running, brake lights on. He said, I'm going to go into the QT. I'm going to do some things. If the car is still there, I'm going to go figure out if everything's okay with this driver, which is a perfectly permissible and, if nothing else, reasonable exercise of his duties to protect and serve. So he goes into the QT. He's in there for 10 or 15 minutes. He comes out. That car is still sitting there. Now he's concerned for the driver. But he also knows, with his training as a DWI, as a member of the DWI task force, that it is not uncommon to find people passed out in their cars, even though they're in park, but with their foot on the brake. He knows, he has training experience in DWI enforcement. So his purpose was sort of twofold. It's, I want to make sure the driver's okay, but it's also possible that this person could be drunk and has been previously operating a motor vehicle. And we know that because the car was on and the brake lights were on.
But I agree that the officer said it wasn't initially an investigative stop, but then, in your opinion, when did the detention start? Was it when, as was argued earlier, that it was when they pulled behind the vehicle and the lights were on?
I would say it's probably slightly after that, when he walks up to the, because if you watch the video, it's, we're just talking about a few seconds. And I've watched the video many times trying to sort out how all this plays out. And as he approaches the car, and this is again from, this is from the dash, the video, the perspective of the dash cam. So he taps the back passenger side, walks up to the car, and taps the window, and then it appears that she reverses. And then he's trying to get her to stop that, because she's going to, if she reverses too fast, she's going to hit his patrol car. So then he taps on the window again, and then she puts it in drive, and then there's a struggle for her to get it back in park. And as it turns out, it's because she's so intoxicated, which she, as soon as she rolled down her window, he testified that she could, he could smell the alcohol in her breath. Then they open, he opened the car door to get her out, and there was vomit in the car. There were open containers. She didn't have her shoes on.
Let me back you up real quick.
Sure.
Okay, so your position then is that when he said not originally or not initially, whatever his verbiage was, to the mm-hmm. reasonable suspicion question, that he's actually talking, your position is he's talking about before he went in to the gas station?
Yes.
It's not talking about after he came out of the gas station.
I'm saying that even before, when he went into the gas station, he at that point was not thinking DWI or reasonable suspicion. At that point, it seems to me from reading the record and understanding his testimony that he was concerned about this driver. It's 10 o'clock at night, it's dark, and it's also January, so it's cold.
I get that, but it is your position that was part and parcel of what was in his mind after 15 minutes of being in the gas station, and he comes out, she's still sitting there.
Yes.
That one, he's worried about community caretaking, her safety, whatever, but he's also thinking about, hey, I'm on the task force, and this a possible DWI in his mind.
Yes, for his...
Now, let me stop you there. If we believe that his testimony is actually pertaining to that period of time,
mm-hmm.
do you agree that we can't even really consider reasonable suspicion in our analysis? Or do you think we still can?
I think you still can, because it could a community caretaking investigation could easily morph into something different when a reasonable suspicion is established. And it was established in this case. And if you look at his training and his experience and his discussion of finding people passed out in their cars with their feet on the brake, and then in particular...
Well, you know, the concern I have is this. Reasonable suspicion is a subjective analysis, correct? It's what's in the police officer's mind.
Yes.
And that usually cuts in favor of the state.
Yes.
Because usually... we may have situations where it's not an illegal act, but mm-hmm. the officer thinks it's an illegal act, and therefore he's justified in making mm-hmm. the stop based on reasonable suspicion.
Mm-hmm.
You agree with that, right?
Yes.
And so I assume, and I really haven't researched it, but if it is a subjective test and we're bound to that, when the police officer says, no, there was no reasonable suspicion, he's in essence telling us, in his mind at the time, there was no reasonable suspicion. Do you agree with that?
I don't, only because he also testified at sort of at the same time that he was concerned about the driver, he says, but I also know from my experience as a DWI task force officer that this is how things play out, that this is how we find people who are so intoxicated they've passed out in their cars. They're often passed out in their cars while the car is in park and their foot are on the brake. They'll be in an abandoned parking lot or along the side of a street. This is not uncommon for him.
What, the appellant in his argument, he talked about policy.
Mm-hmm.
And, this is 10 o'clock. There's fast food restaurants around. I stop all the time when I'm on the road and drive through a fast food, pull over, and literally eat my food in a mm-hmm. parking lot. I don't really want to be bothered by the cops when I'm doing that. What do you say to that? Because really, there's nothing else prior to him pulling up and pulling behind her and mm-hmm. blocking her in that's articulable that could potentially distinguish that situation from somebody like me sitting in their car and just eating their fast food.
Well, I would say the main difference is that most likely you're going to be sitting in your car sitting in park, but your foot's not going to be hanging out on the brake, right? So we're going to take away that. He's clearly going to be able to see that you are eating in your car and that there's nothing to worry about. Here, it was just everything came together for him, I think. I think it's under the totality of the circumstances for this officer came together and allowed reasonable suspicion.
So I can't remember, I'm sorry, if there was any testimony about, obviously, if you engage a parking brake
mm-hmm.
and you're not pushing your foot back and forward, it's not going to flash. It's going to be stagnant. It's going to be
right.
stagnant light.
Right.
Was there any testimony about the fact that that light was stagnant and then it could have been possibly that it was just really bright parking lights?
If you watch the video, it is a stagnant light. It is continuously lit. When he pulls in behind it, is continuously lit. It's not a situation where she's putting her foot on the brake and then taking it off. It's continuously lit. So
how do you distinguish this case from, I believe, the Hernandez case that we previously decided back in 2012?
The Hernandez case involved the issue of burglaries that were supposed to be taking place or had taken place months earlier, and the officer just was suspicious. This, I don't think, is that. This is a trained DWI officer, task enforcement officer, who, from his training experience, knew how these things played out. This wasn't him going on something that he had heard 3 months before where there'd been no reports that evening of burglaries or thefts in the area. If I'm hopefully not confusing my cases. So I think this officer was fully justified, at the very least, in going to check on this woman and make sure that she was okay.
Now, but the question of if pulling in behind somebody when it's dark outside, it's late at night, you block their mm-hmm. exit, you have your emergency lights on, that constitutes an investigative.
It at least constitutes a detention, yes. And I understand that. But either way, either under community caretaking or reasonable suspicion, this should be upheld. The denial of the motion to suppress should be upheld.
So how can we have a judge who hasn't heard the evidence make findings of fact?
That is a problem, but it does happen. I don't know that there's any case law that says this is, a reason for remand in and of itself. Obviously, the judge who signed the findings had the testimony and was able to watch the video, didn't get to see the officer testify live. So really, all that would take away is the singular finding that the officer was, in fact, credible, which perhaps
that's the key of every fact finding.
Perhaps undoes everything. However, If you look at the record at his testimony combined with the videos, I believe there is enough there to support these findings and to support the trial court's denial of the motion to suppress.
The video contradicts his express testimony in the sequence of events, doesn't it?
I tried. I've watched that video, and I am not entirely sure that it does that. It happens so quickly. We are talking about 10 to 12 seconds of time, and I have watched it almost frame by frame to try to sort out, and I do not believe it directly contradicts.
Well, didn't he testify that she was backing up before he walked up to the car? Am I right about that?
He says a couple of different things. He says, well, really he says he tapped on the window and then she started backing up, which is what I see in the video. Hang on just a second. At minute 1 and 34 seconds, he taps the car. Between 1:35 and 1:38, she goes into reverse and he taps on the window. It's hard to, because that's 3 seconds of time. And then from 1:39 to 1:49, again, he's tapping on the window. At 2 minutes, she tries to go into reverse again. And then at 2:01 or so, she puts the car in drive to pull it forward. And then between 2:02 and 2:22, this is when the officer reaches in to help her get the car in park and turn it off for all of their safety, for both of their safety. So I do not believe that that finding number 7 so directly contradicts the video that it should be thrown out. That being said, again, I think both the community caretaking exceptions and the reasonable suspicion exceptions apply. Getting to the community caretaking exception, I understand the right exceptions, and they pin people in pretty well, but I think here, the nature and level of distress exhibited, well, it was the only car in the lot, the brake lights were on, and the officer had testified that people often are passed out in their cars with their feet on the brake. The location of the individual, she was in front of a deserted building in an empty parking lot, alone at night, and again, it was January, so it's cold. She was clearly alone, and to what extent she posed a danger to herself or others, that's unclear. That probably is neutral at this point. But this question of whether or not she had access to assistance, I think can cut against the appellant's argument, because she was a woman alone. It was late at night, it was dark, and he's suggesting, assuming that she's in good enough health to get out of the car, assuming that something worse hasn't happened, that she's supposed to get out of her car and go flag down help in the middle of the night.
The officer wouldn't have known it was a woman and she was alone until after he walked all the way up to the car, after he parked behind her and turned his lights on.
Sure.
You can't tell from the video that it's either a woman or she's alone, because I've watched it also multiple times.
Yeah. I'm just going on what we know now, and I think, the idea that he wanted to check on her, I do not think we should take that lightly. I think that's what our officers are supposed to do when they think someone might be in trouble. And backing up to the original point that he waited 10 to 15 minutes before going to check on her. He saw her originally in the parking lot. It was another 10 to 15 minutes that passed. He did not immediately shoot over there to check, to try to harass her or do a DWI investigation. He gave her some time to sort out whatever was going on. And then he became concerned that she was still there, or that this car was still sitting there.
So if someone is concerned that something may be wrong, they're supposed to wait 10 or 15 minutes before they go figure it out?
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying in this case, I would absolutely not suggest that. But he did, under the circumstances, I think, if we're talking to being harassed in parking lots while we're eating our dinner, you know, because we've gotten some fast food, I think the officer did what he thought was right. He gave her 10 to 15 minutes if she's still there, because he did testify that people often pull into parking lots to, you know, sort out directions, to maybe make a phone call, you know, in other situations. So that could have also been what was going on. It might not have been just that she was in trouble.
Had he testified that he pulled up and before he actually locked her in, basically blocked her in, and could see that she was passed out, then he blocked her in, that would be very helpful to your position. Yeah, I mean, you agree.
I can't deny that. I can't deny that. Certainly there are things about this that would be better for us. But I also believe that the officer, acted reasonably with respect to wanting to find out what if this person was okay. And I also believe that he had reasonable suspicion to also for the detention.
I've got one other question. At the motion to suppress hearing, the state was making an argument that she was criminally trespassing because of the no parking signs. Are you making that argument now?
I am absolutely not making that argument. Absolutely not. No, my only argument would be the DWI. And she had clearly been operating the car. That is a clear, the car was on, the brake lights were on. She'd clearly been operating the car for purposes of DWI. And I don't think there's any indication by the officer that he was going to charge her or investigate her for parking in a no parking zone. That was not his intent. There are no more questions.
I don't have any. Do you have any? Okay, nope. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a brief rebuttal, Your Honors. So first I want to talk about some of this testimony regarding reasonable suspicion for DWI. The training and experience argument is bandied about in a couple of different contexts in this appeal. One is, of course, that the training and experience of the officer doing DWI investigations means that he has reasonable suspicion to go investigate the appellant in this case. Again, I'd like to reiterate, I just believe that he did not have any specific facts, specific articulable facts of a DWI occurring there. He says that, well, yes, I've encountered this before, but there's nothing in the record that says this defendant in this case did the following things, which makes me think that they might have been intoxicated. We're also talking about 10 p.m. We're not talking about 3 a.m. where people are coming home from bars. You know, most people at that time are very well might be engaged in something like that. I would also point to page 9 of the reporter's record, and opposing counsel mentioned this. He goes through his training and experience with that particular vacant lot. And in that particular vacant lot, he doesn't mention that any of the cars that he's seen parked there at night that he's approached were DWI arrests. He says that they were checking for directions, pretty common, waiting for someone and then left. So I think that in this case, the training and experience in this case would actually indicate, well, my experience is most people aren't committing DWI when I go approach them in this particular parking lot. With regard to the sequence of events, and I know this is tough, and I think this also, the point I'm about to make goes to the remand argument as well. I think that that's a
an appropriate resolution here. I don't think it necessarily requires it. I do think that there's enough in the video to see that the sequence of events are off. I do disagree a little bit with opposing counsel as to what those sequence of events are. And the reason why I harp so much on finding a fact number seven is clearly if the officer is involved in a voluntary encounter, literally up until the point at which he approaches the window and sees her passed out, well, then I think we can all agree that a community caretaking exception would apply there where there is no detention at that point.
So is reasonable suspicion necessarily what is in the officer's mind subjectively, or can we look at the evidence, in particular the video evidence, to see if objectively there was a reasonable suspicion at a particular point in time, regardless of what the officer's testimony is?
I think in this case that you could do that. I think objectively all you're going to see from the video is that that she's parked there. You know, I don't think that there's anything and I think that that actually coincides with what the officer testified to in this case too. I think either
but from a legal standpoint, regardless of what we see here, is are we allowed to look at that for objective evidence of a reasonable suspicion and act on that in making our decision, or are we restricted to limit, or are we limited to what was subjectively in the officer's mind?
Yes, I think you're limited to what's subjectively in the officer's mind. I think the State versus Duran case supports that proposition. In that case, that was sort of the issue that was debated in that, where the officer thought he saw an offense but didn't, and that turned out not to be an offense. The state argued, well, there was another offense committed, but the officer had testified that he didn't see anything of. It didn't see any evidence of that offense when he was making the stop. And so I think that applies here. I think if your honors tried to take an objective look at the reasonable suspicion, he's already said that I didn't see anything. I did not have any reason to pull them over. I had no reasonable suspicion of any particular offense, even DWI. I mean, he talks about, well, I thought it might be, and that's why I classify that as a hunch. It could be, but even he doesn't go as far to say as I think that's exactly what was going on here, and here's why. And so I think in this case that you would have to take the officer's subjective, what the officer himself knew and when the officer knew it. It looks like I've run out of time. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, and thank you to both of you for your arguments. They've been very helpful, and the case has now been submitted. Thank you, and you are excused.
Thank you.